Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. Glad to have you with us, and thank you for tuning in. If you are a regular or a new listener tuning in for the first time, good to have you here. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from Sweden in Scandinavia. We are here with a new program every Thursday and Sunday. You can find us from around the globe 24/7 through our website, redicecreations.com. That's redicecreations.com. On our website, you'll find Radio Archives, a very busy news section with interesting, important, upsetting, and also some positive stories from around the world. We also have a member section containing extended interviews with many of our guests, short films, live feeds, and where you can find our entire and growing radio archive, going back over 2 years. Today we have author and researcher Michael Tesarion back with us on the program, and Michael has a new book on astrotheology coming out soon. After he's concluded his magnum opus on Irish origins, he's coming out with a new one, so he's definitely keeping busy. And this is what we're going to dive into here today. The website is michaeltesarion.com. That will take you to all of Michael's other sites with writings, books, DVDs, and much more. But the main site that you need to take a look at relating to our program today is astro-theology.net. That's astro-theology.net. Michael is also one of the speakers at the upcoming Beyond Knowledge conference in Liverpool, England. So if you're in the UK area, or somewhere in Europe for that matter, and want to catch Michael's talk on a Beyond Knowledge conference, stay tuned. We're going to talk more about that at the end of our program here today. We had a lot of requests to have you back on the show, Michael, and we've been eager ourselves to do another program with you. So it's a pleasure having you back. Hi and welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Henrik. It's always a pleasure, and always thank you for your great show and for the time that you spend with myself and other, you know, authors and researchers. It's always, you know, appreciated.
Very good. Excellent to have you back, Michael. It's going to be a great show. And I want to begin here today to read a quote from your new upcoming book. And I really like this paragraph a lot. Christians do not need to find salvation from sin. They need to find salvation from priestly deceivers who have everything to lose should their congregations discover the true origins of their religion. They need to be saved from mythmongers and forgers guilty of cannibalizing and re-scripting the traditions of the ancient cults. Christian theology is based on astro-theology. It is a corrupt hybrid of Irish Druidism and Egyptian animism. The future of Christianity depends upon this truth being widely known and accepted. It depends upon the exposure of deceivers in high places who continue to profit from the ignorance and blind faith of millions of men and women who, despite their own resistance and apathy, deserve to know the truth. Last year, you did a five-hour DVD, Michael, entitled Astrotheology and Sidereal Mythology. And now, pretty soon here, you have a new book then coming out on the subject of astrotheology. Is this a companion book to the DVD, or why did you decide to write this, Michael?
It is a companion. Henrik, thanks first for, you know, reading that caption from the book. And yeah, the DVD has been very successful. It's one of the first, you know, DVDs on this subject. It's not the first. You know, of course, my mentor, Jordan Maxwell, has labored for 30 years to bring this to the fore. And he's the, you know, the ultimate student and researcher in this subject. And it's through my studies with him, you know, that it honed a lot of my interest and also my own studies. I had studied astrotheology before I'd met Jordan, but I didn't. Man, there was just so many pieces missing. You know, I didn't have the full picture. And of course, I didn't realize that such a man like him existed, who'd already, you know, did the 30 years of research and could answer all of these, you know, questions that I had. And believe me, if, you know, he wasn't in my life, there would have been no way that either my DVD nor my book, you know, would have come into existence. You know, both these items are dedicated to Jordan, and always, you know, every time I even write a sentence or, you know, even continue my studies, I'm always conscious of his contribution, because I mean, you can study something for a long, long time, but this is an extremely diverse subject, actually. It encompasses, I've always described astrotheology as the subject of subjects, because like in many of these arcane areas, you're not just studying one subject, you're studying many. It's not just about beating one subject to death, It's about trying to encompass all of the world's mysteries. It's a real task, So I had a lot of these pieces, say, of the jigsaw, but, I didn't know the full picture. So it was just great for, to get in touch with Jordan and then realize that we had so much in common with this and to continue. So that the DVD, first and foremost, was put together. But then, it's been just so successful, and people have loved it, and they've wanted more, They wanted more. And so then I thought, okay, well, look, we can do part two, look at, Astrotheology DVD part two. But then what that does is it breaks up the Origins and Oracle series of programs.
Mm-hmm.
Because then people are going to go, okay, well, wait a minute, I've got volume one, but then, volume two, it sort of pulls the Astrotheology out to be a box set of its own, which I don't want to have happen.
Right, right.
So, and more importantly than that is, like, how many DVDs could you produce on astrotheology? I mean, the thing, no amount of DVDs could really do justice to the subject, what I'm saying?
Right, right.
So it just felt like the time was right now to collate my notes and, collate all the material I've been collecting for years. People have also just said, we want more on this, why don't you do a book? So again, to answer your question in brief, it is just a people's demand, basically, because again, I didn't plan this. It wasn't even planned last year. It was something that people have said, we want more on that particular subject. We love the DVD.
Right.
Maybe we can do a book. And it fits because my Atlantis book is a companion, after all, of the Atlantis DVD.
Right.
So I've already done one. I've already done a companion book to the DVD. So I thought, okay, well, why not? Let's make Astrotheology have a companion book, So it should be done in about a month or so,
Very good. The book and the DVD, of course, deal with the hidden roots of religion. Of course, the first question that comes to mind is, why would one want to study Christianity's ancient hidden roots, particularly when so many young people nowadays could, not care less about religion, and since so many believers, I guess, have fallen away from their religions?
They have. Of course, that has been the case in the last 30 years. It's... I guess the best way to answer that is that the church has nothing to fear from those people who've turned away. A lot of people who are agnostic, a lot of people who will become atheistic, they think in their minds that by them not participating, because they just don't go to church and get sprinkled with holy water, that in some way the church is in some way threatened by that.
Right.
Let me make it very clear that that is not the case. Just because you have found out that it's not worth your time, or you have a few, quandaries about it, or you didn't like the pastor, or you don't like the whole suit and tie gig or whatever, just because you have bowed out for whatever reason is in no way threatening to the establishment that has caused so much misery in this world. And the reason is because an ignorant agnostic and an ignorant atheist is about as little of a threat, is about the same amount of threat as the ignorant believer sitting in the pews. The main common denominator is ignorance. It doesn't mean you're ignorant outside the door of the church, carrying on your little daily life, or you're ignorant sitting listening to the guy every Sunday on the hour. It is of no importance, as long as ignorance, is the key. And this is unfortunately what it is. So my message, Jordan's message, is not just to bore agnostics and atheists who've already go, look, I know it's all bunk. I already don't go to church. I already, could care less about this. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in anything. It's not just to say, pat these people on the back and go, well done. That's mighty good of you to, know that.
Right.
It's to say that your ignorance is still participant. I don't want people to turn away from Christianity or Judaism or any of these Leviathans ignorantly. I want both the believers, this is the people who read the Bible and are studying it assiduously and who want to know the mystery of these traditions, and I want the person who doesn't want to do anything with the institution to be empowered through knowledge.
Right.
This is the key thing,
Yeah.
This is the key thing to remember.
So
and of course the most important reason is because why would you want to study religion? Is because there is an entire crime syndicate out there called the Vatican.
Right.
Called the Judeo-Christian organization that is, as you said in the beginning, profiting from the millions of people who don't know that this religion is damaging to your health. They'll put smoke kills on every box of cigarettes, you know, and signs all over the freeways and all other things, you know, don't put the cat in the microwave, you know. I mean, you've got lists, especially in America, you know, you have to hold the handrails, walk on the left. You'll have every kind of, you know, mantra repeated dozens of times about your other safety,
right,
so-called. But where is the skull and bones, you know, poison, deadly, lethal, toxic waste? Where's that sign on religion? Nowhere to be found.
Right, right.
You know, and then people look at me and Jordan and think, oh boy, you guys are, you know, iconoclastic. You guys are really something. You know, keep on putting this religion down. Oh, yeah? Well, you know, let's take around the graveyards and see how many people, you know, they'd be agreeing only they're dead.
And also, you know, if we study a little bit of on the background on some of these other so-called, you know, isms that have popped up lately, like communism, so forth, Nazism, there is, in many cases, if you follow that evidence, of trails of evidence, a lot of evidence saying that this is actually connected with the Vatican and the Catholic Church, and then the whole, you know, situation becomes instantaneously very much different, you know.
It does. And ultimately, you see, this has been proven. This has been, you know, hands down proven. I mean, Avro Manhattan, now you have more recently John Phelps. There's not a stone that's been left unturned in the research community proving that the Vatican has not only been in cahoots with the Soviets, with Mussolini, with the fascists, Russia, with Hitler. You know, this has all been right up, you know, clearly made into plain view as far as I'm concerned. And I'm not talking about Roman Catholics, of course, endorsing any of this. This is not what we mean. The Vatican is an institution. It's a state within a state. It's a political edifice.
Yeah.
But of course, those people who've tracked all of this, you know, financial, economic, militaristic sort of goings on, that's great. My work focuses more on their mind control, you know, the whole other psychodynamics.
Right.
Of the way that they might be controlling man and what it is in man also that allows himself to be, you know, so deceived like this.
Do the clergymen know that they're, you know, consciously deceiving people?
For the most part, yeah. For the most part, they do. I mean, I have no problem understanding that because I've come from Belfast where it's very flagrant. That's not every person. There are true Christians out there who believe in Christ and, you know, they think they're absolutely sure that the moral code, the Mosaic commandments, etc., you know, is the way to go. You know, I don't have an argument with that. You know, I don't have an argument with virtue. I don't have an argument with morality. I don't have an argument with the Bible per se. It's just a book. You know, it's what's been done in the name of God and in the name of that book. You see, don't forget that we can split hairs and say, isn't it really sad? Not that Christianity exists, but isn't it sad that man needs to be promised an eternal paradise, meaning an eternal reward after he's dead in order to stop him from doing the most cruel and sadistic acts while he's alive? I mean, he doesn't do it of his own nature because it's easy that some, you know, nice religion can just come along and just calmly remind people, be moral, don't do bad things. No, no. You have to create an entire promissory web and really insinuate into human beings that you're going to live forever after you're dead and you will have endless reward. So for goodness sake, for God's sake, don't do evil things now. And man sits there thinking, well, you know, chewing his bone beside the fire. Well, I guess, all right then, I'll buy into that. Maybe I can, you know, be less sadistic, less, you know, less horrific, less brutal.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so, to me, you know, it's outrageous that such a thing would have to be concocted in order to get man to be virtuous. You know, is man not virtuous, or is there perhaps some other way, a better way of bringing out that virtue, or is it probably just better to face facts and realize, you know, it's not going to happen? Instead of concocting this lie mechanism that says, okay, we'll give you this if you do this, we'll give you that. You know,
it's a false virtue. It's a virtue that maybe have been put upon man, maybe at the wrong time. Also, then in a way,
yeah. It's a virtue that is compelled. It's a virtue that is not articulated to his deeper drives. It's basically an enforcement. It's basically a commandment, as they say, meaning from outside. You have external virtue. Just show external virtue, and you'll get, you know, basically a spiritual reward for it. You know, just conform. It's a form of conformity. It's not like the Socratic way or the Zen way or the mystical way. It's not about man learning. I mean, absolutely intimately learning the secret that if you harm another, you harm yourself, like Socrates said.
Yeah.
It's not about man being taught to have such an awareness of the connections between psychic and spiritual energy that they understand that to, you know, kill animals or to, you know, hurt the earth or to hurt other people is devastating to your own spirit. That would be then where the real virtue would arise. No, this is a draconian, you know, it's not even right to even call it virtue. It's more just a convention is the, probably a better word, social convention.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you know, going back to your question about whether the clergy are conscious, I believe for the very most part they are. 9 times out of 10 they are. But remember, if you work in a chocolate factory, you're probably the last person who'll eat chocolate, right? Because you're sick of it, because you see it all day long.
Yeah.
So just because these people work within the religion and they know that it's a, you know, full of nonsense, it's all lies, it's astrotheology, you know, as my work has proven, doesn't mean that they themselves eat off that same plate.
Right.
That's just a plate that's good for everyone else. You know, they're hypocrites. And the interesting thing about the word hypocrite is that the word actually was a word in Greece that simply meant actor. Did you know that? It just meant actor on a stage.
Really?
That's where the word comes from. It just meant a person who wears a mask or a person who is playing a part that's been scripted for them by an unseen playwright. Yeah.
That's interesting.
So, you know, in my work, I've talked about these unseen playwrights
and
the Atonists and all. Then we have this coterie who is literally without virtue. They may have this conventional morality. They may have the trappings, the external lineaments of morality and all of this, and the, you know, holier than thou, sanctimonious cover. But these are the hypocrites. They actually are just simply actors, and they get a kick out of it. You know, that's a fine. They don't have to eat the chocolate. They don't have to eat the same dish as the people in the theater. This is, you know, and I mean, we even need to look in, if you do your homework in the Jewish tradition, you'll know that the Jews and the original Hebrew rabbis, they all knew about the existence of the zodiac. They even call it the rota signorum, the wheel of signs, the wheel of the signs.
Mm.
You know, the Jewish and the Christian priests absolutely know that their religion is an outgrowth of solar cultism, you know, and they know that, and they also know that the cultism's origins is Irish and not necessarily Egyptian only. You know, believe me, it's taken centuries for them to even admit. And of course, they haven't admitted it. It's scientists who have discovered this. It's archaeologists who have discovered the, you know, the importance of Egypt.
Right.
So it's even taken, the clergy didn't come along and tell us all of this. Hell, they wouldn't have even told us that the world was circular. They'd have you happily believing it was flat and that, you know, devils are going to, you know, steal your body if you have sex with somebody, you know, outside marriage and all that stuff. They'd be happy to keep us all in that framework, you know, of fear and guilt and ignorance. So it's not that they've come running to us to accept, to tell us about the wonderful role of the Egyptians in Christianity. That's been brought out by other scholars.
Right.
And they're certainly never going to admit the role of Ireland, you know. So it's for people like ourselves to start asking the questions and not just blindly accepting all this.
Will things change? I mean, is there hope that tomorrow we can be rid of this poison then?
Well, it's only like the poet Shelley said. This is the Victorian poet Shelley. He said, absolutely, when the last king is strangled with the guts of the last priest. And I you know, look around the world today and don't see any other possible, you know, scenario there. It literally will be. Because remember, these actors love the gig, you know, and they're not going to give up of their own free will. They do know what they're doing. They do know that they've cannibalized the ancient traditions. But waiting for them to fold up, that's like Colonel James Bogart said, you know, if you're waiting for Lord Rothschild to roll up his little red carpet and run off back to Europe and say, hey, boss, you know, we couldn't handle it, you may have a long, long wait.
Right.
And believe me, these princes and religious types are, you know, they're not going anywhere. So as Shelley said, you know, the last king strangled with the guts of the last priest. This is basically what you're going to have to wait for. Unless people start, you know, unless we do understand what Jordan and myself are saying and end this and really bring the truth home to these people. But also, you see, no, because remember, man needs religion because man is not doing his own homework. So the reason why men are into theology is because they're not, you know, they're not into psychology. And unfortunately, man needs to be led. You know, he may be intellectually and technically developed, but he's not emotionally or psychologically developed. He's very, in fact, infantile and very fragile on those levels, like a small child. This is unfortunately what we find in a study of mankind, that emotionally they're very backward. So, you know, this priestarchy has nothing to fear. This priesthood is there for people as soon as they're traumatized, as soon as any kind of upset comes to them emotionally, you see, any kind of upset in the domestic sphere, or even now, of course, in the political sphere, where there's so much trauma going around, all being designed to happen, to force people back into the churches. And even though we said earlier in the program about, you know, that there are agnostics and there are atheists, that is not to forget for a moment that right now the demographics is up again, especially in an American context. People are flooding back to churches. They're flooding back not only to decent churches, but to these, you know, evangelists who are maniacs. Uh-huh. People are flooding back to listen to, you know, it's incredible that we have an influx again and a rising interest in the church.
The economics is a little bit down. Things are not maybe on the up and up on all fronts, and then people potentially, they go back to the old patterns, you know, because that's, you know, routine, I guess, again, you know, falling into that.
That's right. Exactly. But let us never forget, and of course this makes these evangelists, you know, incredibly happy, and also the fact that nobody refutes them. Everybody believes every piece of rubbish they say. Because remember, a good 80% of what evangelists say is actually not even in the Bible. The stuff that they spout, and this has been the case even since evangelism started, you know, whether it's about the rapture or about other things that they go on incessantly about, or like, for instance, tithing and giving your money and, you know, all this kind of, none of this is actually in the Bible at all. In fact, quite the opposite. The Bible actually, you know, refutes common prayer and refutes all of these kinds of things. And Christ, his own words, is saying, look, I didn't come here to have you help your brother.
Yeah.
You know, in the book of Matthew, it's saying, I came with a sword to divide man from all of these social and domestic roles and from his silly wives and his daughters and sons and stuff like that. How come they don't read that?
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, but what we've got here, my friend, is that we've got the janitors, we've got the butlers, and we got the gatekeepers in the mansion wearing the master's best suit, sipping his brandy from his decanters and putting their feet up on his leather, you know, while he's out to lunch. We don't have true spirituality in the world. We don't even have true psychology in the world. We don't have any interest from the masses into anything real. Nothing. And please don't tell me about the New Age movement, you know, being real. That's another concoction for the most part.
Right.
So we have then, the mansion is empty, and all the butlers and the maids and the scullery maids and the you know, the kitchen staff are all up, you know, lollygagging around, you know, having a ball. And that's what these priests are, because they've annihilated the Druids, like we spoke of in other shows. They've killed the Wicca. They've massacred all throughout the world. They've killed off anyone else who would know these truths that we're talking about.
Yeah.
And so they have the mansion all to themselves. And if we find the place in wreck and ruin, well, it's our fault as much as it is theirs.
Okay, I guess we can move away into another little bit of area that is interesting in regards to your latest work and you've been writing about, and that is that you said that the pyramid of Egypt was built by visitors from the northwestern lands, and that the very word Giza means goatman or goths. Care to elaborate on that?
Well, yeah, this was, you know, an example of what I'm talking about when I say that these modern clergy or prelates, you see, have, you know, not only lied to us about the role of Egypt, but they've, you know, they've totally done a number on the story of Ireland. But the more information that comes out, the more the people, you know, see the facts, the more that we start to see that there's nothing really extraordinary at all about accepting that they, you know, that these connections existed. Do you remember that they found cocaine in the various tombs and in the coffins of mummies? They found coca leaves, you know.
Indeed.
And you know, the experts are still completely bamboozled about how there could be connections between, say, Egypt and South America, you know.
Right.
And we're still living in that era yet today where there's a lot of head scratching about this, you know, and, oh my goodness, you know, could there be a connection between, say, Scandinavia and Britain, you know, and to Egypt? I mean, to me, it's like utterly preposterous, you know,
because
the history books are already showing you that there was connections, you know, between European, technically Northern European people, like the Scythians. And, you know, the land of Galilee, Judea, and so forth and so on. So, I mean, it's just out of this world. But that's exactly the point you're saying is absolutely right. They've even discovered, did you know that long ago this was discovered, I mean, it's been covered up, that in Dendera, which is a very famous temple in Egypt, and it's also very famous because it features one of the most incredible ancient zodiacs in the temple of Dendera. Well, they discovered parchments, documents in there that show that the Ari, or the Aria, were responsible for actually building the Great Pyramid. You know, this had already been independently discovered by other professors, but they actually found, you know, because people scream at you about evidence. Well, they found the evidence. And they, even the architect, the main architect's name was given. And his name ended with the root Ari, A-R-I.
Right.
Which people who know my work on the Irish origins, you see, know is the Aria. It's actually one of the names of the land of Ireland. So anybody who had Ari in their name, it not only meant that they were from the West, it distinguished them as a Druid, as an Aria, one of the Aria. And the name of the man who built the pyramid, who designed it, his name was the Ari. Hmm. And that positions this person, or his ancestors, you see, you know, in the West. He's a Western adept. And his title, not the meaning of the name, but the title that was given to this character, and the caption I'm talking about is going to be in the new book on astrotheology. His title was Keeper of the Secrets. Hmm. So here we are, you know, the Keeper of the Hermetic Secrets, the man of the West. And this is indeed a great secret. You better believe it's a secret. That, you know, you can better believe that Rome and all of these different Orthodox churches who've built their own foundations on the ruins of these ancient people are not going to want this knowledge to be known. How many people listening to us? I mean, let's just cut to the chase, you know, and be very brutal about it. How many people who are listening to this show today ever even heard the word Aria?
Not many.
They may have heard the word Arian, but my God, that's no good, because whoever heard that word has certainly had it, has got a negative conception of the word. Okay,
that's,
so even those who
right.
go, well, I've heard of it. I've heard of the word Arian. Oh, yes, that's an evil word. That's, oh, that's terrible. That's a racist word, you see. So there's my point.
Right.
Yeah, even if you have heard of it, you haven't heard of it. So let's make this very clear. And the reason is because you are not meant to hear about it. You're not being told the truth about history. And this age-old fraud, you see, has to be continued to be exposed. You can never let up on this until the people of the world have the truth, whether they want it or not.
You know, that potentially could lead us into the area of, you know, just for a moment here, speculate that during the Nazis, if what we talked about earlier, if it is true that the Vatican now again then is behind Nazism and all of the perhaps even beforehand, the theology, so to speak, that arose before Nazism became popular, so to speak, in Germany, that all the surrounding myths about the Aryans, and they were, you know, off to Tibet, obviously, India, looking for this race, do you think that could possibly have been one of the, you know, concoctions around this, even to at the end of the day, when everything, all the, you know, World War II is over, everything's over, they know that this race, you know, allegedly race for them then, is going to have such a negative connotation that people, consequently after that, is never going to look in that area again. What do you think?
And isn't it true? We only need to look at the results. As I've just said, everyone who has heard that word is going to almost, you know, whisper it because they're so afraid of what a word means, you know?
Right.
Look at the word anti-Semite. You know, let's not question whether there's any logic to the word or to all the, you know, debris that surrounds these terms. We don't even need to get into that. Just try using that term. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that goes also for even the term Nazi. When I look at even the terms that these people are using, even to distinguish themselves, I'm saying, okay, a bunch of Nazis over here are talking about Aryan over here.
Yeah.
I'm worried about the word Nazi because I recognize that word. That word, it means serpent priest. That word also represented a cult of sorcerers, you see, whose knowledge was based on ancient, you know, traditions of the past. People have even tracked that word back to the Sumerian, to, you know, one of the Sumerian goddesses and her children and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm already thinking, well, who's this? Then I already know that the entire so-called Nazi experiment had nothing to do with Germany and Germans. And it's also part of the reason why I despise people who will use that word arbitrarily to signify Germans and Germany. That's absolutely not allowed.
Right.
A Nazi is not necessarily a German. In fact, anyone wants to study, you know, George Bush and his clan will soon find that out.
That's right.
There's more fascists sitting in London and up in Washington than ever has been within the borders of the land of Germany. So, and Israel goes the same. But the thing is that this was a British experiment. And you're absolutely right. When you commit an experiment is not just one experiment. It's subdivided into many experiments. So they wanted to damage the name Aria, which was absolutely necessary, because you see too many Victorian scholars from Germany and from Scandinavia, from London, from England, you know, were finding out a lot of what I'm writing about now, they already were getting onto this.
Mm-hmm.
And so this could not be. There had to be a wholesale damaging of this term, absolutely, because if it wasn't, then within a very, very short time, during the 1930s, human beings were going to discover that the Western Arya came out of Scandinavia and Ireland and Europe and literally went as far as where? Well, the north of India, because isn't that where also the word Arya appears?
Right.
So the whole thing, Henrik, would have been out of the bag. The whole thing would have been out of the bag. You wouldn't have to have Michael Tessarin writing about it, you know, in 2000 and, seven.
Right.
It would have been out of the bag back in 1930. It already was about to get out of the bag, that there was a worldwide order that literally, whether it was on horseback or whether it was by sea, but the fact remains that their symbols of the swastika, which is a symbol that can only be seen in the sky, in the night sky, you see, from the northern climes, many of the etymologies, many of the traditions. For goodness sake, we're in the era now where they're digging them up. Look at the Padraic people and the Tarim Basin people, you see. They're all, you know, with Danish headgear and Nordic features or whatever, the whole thing. Everyone, you know, should know about this.
Right.
So what would have happened in the 1920s and 30s? The fear was great amongst the establishment. So these knights, Nazi knights, who were mostly of, British agents, it's all been exposed. This is what happened, that the name and a lot of the mythologies was contorted into something that would be so radical, so illogical, but literally they could use it in the aftermath. They could use it forever to make sure that nobody ever would dabble in this, because on their chart, they have many levels of conspiracy and many levels of cover-up.
Right.
Have many black operations, but they also have a red file. I mean, they've really got a major, for your eyes only file of the most important cover-ups that can never be blown by anyone. And you know, that's what one thing that keeps me very positive about the Asia we're living in is that finally we are actually finding out some of this top level. You know, we're sort of cracking the code, and we are going into their sacred cows, and we are going into some taboo areas and exposing it. And this is one of the things that is quite thrilling and inspiring about this age that we're living in.
Indeed, very good. And you also, you know, speaking of going back to the serpent and the connection there, that you also show that the common link between the Western and Eastern schools involves the use of the serpent symbol, and that the symbol of the serpents ultimately refer to the stars and the zodiac. Tell us about that.
That's right. And you're basically talking, you're covering, you know, stuff that's been put in the Irish Origins book, and I thank you for that. And you're right. And it's not just the serpent symbol, it's the eagle, you know, with the star, just the very simple of a symbol of a star itself. But the serpent is much more important as a study for people who are really want to, you know, nail this down, that this global connection between the West and the East, especially in the movement of the elements of civilization from the West to the East. You see, I'm so used to thinking in terms of that, it's difficult for me to, you know, even read people or listen to people who think it's the other way around, you know, as great as their research may be.
Right.
Because immediately, you know, bells just go off in my mind is, why does this person not get this? What the hell is the matter, you know? But then I forget they're coming out of the normal schools, they're coming out of the normal literature, you know? So,
right.
But that aside, one of the things that really nails this down is the symbol of the serpent. Remember for a start that serpents as physical snakes don't exist in Ireland.
That's right, yeah.
You know, that's pretty much a proven fact. Yet the symbol of the serpent is everywhere. My God, you only have to look at the Book of Kells and the ancient manuscripts, and before that, the stones, the images on stones, the images on the ancient monoliths, to see the serpentine symbol all over the place. You only need to study Druidism to hear that they spoke of themselves as the adders or as the nadreds. They even used the word gnadir. Nadir meant, you know, the men of the serpent.
Mm-hmm.
But then what do we find in the Bible? It just leaps out at me every time, you know, and I have put this into the new astrotheology book. The terms Christ and the terms Messiah both refer to the serpent, by the way. Most people have understood that the word Christ and the word Messiah means the anointed one.
Right.
Because literally this picture is showing the anointing. And a scene, the book, the Dead Sea Scrolls talk about it. And I mean, for goodness sake, even in the Bible they talk about it. They talk about John the Baptist, you know, initiating Jesus. They talk about Mary, you know, anointing him with oil.
Right.
Basically a decent Christian concordance will admit that the word Christ probably means the anointed one, or it's a term that basically is similar to Messiah, etc. But what they will never tell you is what's next. Where did the anointing come from? The anointing was an Egyptian ritual that was done on very special initiates of the mystery schools. It was done to the pharaoh, it was done to the princes, it was done to the kings. But the oil that was used in the anointing, Henrik, was the oil of the crocodile god Sobek, or the crocodile of the Nile. They would actually, yeah, and that's where the word Messiah comes from. Mesu, which meant also son of, and Messa, M-E-S-S-E-H, like Messa, referred to the crocodile of the Nile and the oil that was made from the body of the crocodile. It was very sacred because it was God Sobek.
Right.
And we have this drink, this, you know, this soft drink today called Sobe.
Right. Right.
It's just missing a K at the end, and it also has a reptilian symbol on it. Well, this is
really?
The corporations know, but the average listener to this show doesn't know, and better start knowing. Is that this is an old story. You're being anointed when you drink Sobe. Yeah, they love it. You're the Christ now. You're the Messiah. Have a drink.
Right, right.
But before I get into all that stuff of the corporate world, come back to the idea that the anointing was the oil. But here's then you take it to the next step. Because these Egyptians weren't pagan madmen who just thought, let's, you know, kill a crocodile, take his fat, and then anoint our kings with it. No.
Right, right.
It was deeper than that. This crocodile god, the crocodile of the Nile, represented the heavenly crocodile, and this is where the astrotheology now comes in.
Right.
So I'm glad you brought this up because it's a perfect portrayal. The crocodile represented the crocodile up there, meaning literally in the northern sky, there's a constellation that's been known for 25,000 years or more called Draco.
Right.
And it's a very, very, very large constellation that today is known as Draco, the dragon, or the serpent. But the Egyptians looked at it like the lizard of the serpent, the lizard serpent of the Nile, basically the crocodile. So it wasn't that they were initiating the pharaoh based on something to do with a crocodile. It was a symbol. The crocodile and the fat of the crocodile was a symbol for the astrological constellation of Draco, which was always seen as a protector of sacred knowledge. And the reasons why Draco is considered a protector and all of that is in the book. It's an elaborate story about the circumpolar stars and all of that.
Right,
Just in short, when you are now being initiated, and then why do you think it is that afterwards the crown of the pharaoh or the prince is literally what? What does he wear on his head? Haven't people seen it? It's the Uraeus serpent, isn't it?
Ah, yeah, of course, yeah. Obviously.
Right, the coronet that you see. Exactly. So this is what he is given as a crown after he's initiated under Draco.
Right.
The pharaoh is now initiated as a master astrologer, a master adept. His tutelary symbol, his emblem has now become the serpent, just like the caduceus is used on the medical corporations, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And he's now under the serpent. But going back to the original point, this then connects him with the West and Ireland, because that's exactly what the initiates, adepts, magi, were called in Ireland. They were called the Nadreds, the serpent people, the serpent priests. So if we happen to have the exact same ritual on two parts of the globe, amongst only royalty and initiated members of mystery schools, this isn't any jack on the street having this happen to them, this is only the very elite.
Right.
And the connecting thread is this astrotheology and the connection of the northern constellation of Draco. You know, you can throw more books at me that tell that there's no connection between Egypt and Ireland, etc., and you know, it's not going to mean a thing, because the words, the etymology cuts through all that, Henrik. The symbolism is where people need to become literate to, because the symbolism in the words is your lifeline. It's your Ariadne's threads through the labyrinth of lies that the historians and the so-called experts have put in front of us.
Right.
So here we have the messiahs of Egypt and the messiahs, plural, of Ireland, and the messiahs of the Babylonians, and the Christs, the cursed, the Christs, the Karasts, are the serpent ones. They're initiated in as astrologers, you see. This is the whole incredible connection here. So when you hear Prince Charles's mother, Queen Elizabeth, in the time of inauguration of her son, saying, by this dragon. Why dragon? Because he's being made Prince of Wales, right? And the Welsh symbol is the dragon.
Right.
But so why is she saying, why is he sitting on a throne shaped like a dragon? And then she says to him, by this dragon, by this serpent, by the power of this dragon, you are made into the Prince of Wales. You have the power to rule, and your power is given to you by this dragon.
I had no idea.
Is there
idea.
Something, you know, that they're saying we're meant to know about here?
Huh. I had no idea that she was saying this. I had no idea.
That's right. Huh. In the coronation.
Huh.
Of course, you'll not see it, because they've edited, you know, every little television broadcast of this. They ain't going to show you that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But believe me, that's what was going on in the full coronation of Prince Charles in Wales.
Hmm.
That's why Wales has a dragon symbol. That's why Scotland has a dragon symbol. That's why the Draco, the dragons, the bloodline, all of these terms of the dragon. People have done some marvelous work to show, you know, a certain amount of where this comes from.
Mm.
But they've always tend to leave out, Henrik, the astrological or astro-mythological story that is lying behind all the texts and lying behind all the scriptures.
That's right.
When you hear Christ talk about, what does he tell his disciples? Be as wise as serpents.
That's right.
Why would he say that? And anyway, what does it mean? What on earth does it mean to be as wise as a serpent? Well, not the serpent crawling on the floor. The serpents who are standing on two legs.
Right.
The serpents who've been sitting on the thrones of the greatest civilizations on the world. That's what Jesus meant when he's telling his chump disciples, listen, get off your ass, get with this knowledge.
Right.
Be as smart as the most intelligent men of the world. Be as smart as the serpent men, the serpent priest who'd leave you in the dust. Yeah. This is the tutorial. This is the subject matter.
And as you say, it's very important and a very key piece of the puzzle to tie in the astrotheology here, because again, so many people are very astute to point out the different symbolism around the around the world at this point, you know, that has to do with the serpent and so forth. I mean, that, as you say, it's a very key point and very important. The question that arises also is where did, you know, the those who were looking at the stars to begin with, where did they get these, you know, this idea from?
I believe from the West. I believe from this area that we're talking about that have different names. You know, the Druidic area, and again, I emphasize the word area was actually the name of Ireland. It wasn't I with an I, Ireland. It was Ari land, the land of the Arya, the noble ones. They get to the east because these tremendous catastrophes ripped the countryside apart. And people can go and just look at that for themselves. If they know how to look at geography, they'll see that the lands of Britain and Scandinavia were torn to shreds. These people were displaced, as we've said. They moved across the land bridges, like we said in previous shows. And they were the Magi. You know, they were basically, if not the creators of many civilizations in the east, they were certainly welcomed guests of those civilizations in the east.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not a fanatic. I'm not saying they necessarily created the Babylonian or Sumerian, you know, civilizations, but they certainly would have been very, very much involved in aspects of those civilizations. I mean, to me, I have no problem accepting that they absolutely did create those civilizations. There's a lot of evidence for that.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But at the very least, Rick, as far as the Indus Valley goes, as far as the, you know, Sumerians go, as far as Babylonian goes, the Medes, I believe that this is basically, you're talking about one global group of theocrats here.
Yeah.
And it's from them that we get the idea to look to the stars. But there's a psychology behind that, you see. Because just like we said, people today don't really take on board that they have an unconscious mind and that there's so much inner homework to be done.
Mm.
And they don't take on board the fact that if you don't do that homework, you inevitably breed a world full of deceivers to, you know, create your religions for you on an external way.
Hmm.
But what also has to be understood is that this psychological understanding is not a new thing. The ancients absolutely did not see the world as being divided like we would do today, in the sense that they taught that there was intimate connections between the psychic world, you see, and the physical world. Physic and psyche were the same.
Yeah.
There was no division like we've been trained. We've been literally trained to think of the physical world and the inner world of your own mind as two separate things.
Yeah.
In other words, that there's big differences between the microcosmic realm and the macrocosmic realm. This, of course, was never understood by the ancients. So when they studied the stars, it wasn't like today we would imagine it, which looks almost like a peculiar, if not pseudo-scientific, kind of understanding.
Right.
Well, it's actually our deficit. We are the ones who've got the faulty, distorted, contorted thinking. We think it's mad because we do think of those things as just, you know, material objects out in space. Mm-hmm. We don't know anything about the archetypal realm or these intimate connections between consciousness and matter. But the ancients knew it, and they knew that if you study something external, you are studying yourself. You are studying man. There's no divide or division between it. You know, it's just impossible to accept that, you know, so many civilizations could divide the zodiac into similar, you know, houses. And remember, I'm being quite brief about this. There's many other points of similarity. the symbols of the constellations, worshiping the same stars for the same reasons, etc. You find all of this. So you could accept that, you know, all of this happened what's called autothoniously, meaning individually, per nation, per cult. But I think that the chances of that, you know, just from a pure point of probability, is so astronomical, it couldn't be the truth. Logically, it could. The reason is that one elite group, you know, like the trickle-down theory, that this was the way that the great magi understood the stars. This was their particular syllabus, and then the syllabus was then transplanted and copied and emulated and eventually, of course, corrupted by these different cults and these different churches and these different nations. That's the way to look at it.
If we take into account here also the by now very known theory of diffusionism, that, you know, the seas are open roads to travel, there's a very clear and easy connection between the probably back then a global seafaring people that, again, obviously were looking for the stars because that's the place where you navigate from, or, you know, you navigate via the stars. And there's also the possibility that the most clear connection between, first of all, why they were looking at the stars to begin with, but also that this was a global civilization, and they obviously discovered the zodiac through looking at the stars, and this was transplanted globally. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. No question about it in my mind. And it, all I would add to that is that there's two things. One is that the intelligence level of those people can now not be doubted. So let's cast away this derogatory, denigrating feeling that these people were just, you know, barbarians.
Right.
Because anyone who could navigate the high seas, anyone who could demarcate the zodiac, anyone who could know that much about the behavior of certain stars and constellations, let's go even further, anyone who could calculate precession of the equinoxes here, my God, what are we talking about? We're talking about scientists, incredible intelligence, the Naros cycle, the Sothic cycle, the famous, what's the other one, the Saros cycle. We're talking about cycles that last multi-thousands of years.
Yeah.
But you see, you used the word navigate. Navis, that comes from novice, N-A-V-I-S. What do you think a novice is in the church? What do you think a sexton is, or a minister, or a magistrate, or a nun, or a monk, or a master, or a minister? You see, or a monastery. My God, we're knee-deep in astrotheology when you really get into what's going on here.
Yeah.
The navigators, the novice, the ones who measure God, right? Measure the stars, watch the rising and the setting of the sun.
Mm.
This is picked up in the Christian world, if people only know how to read the signs and look at the etymology and so on. But you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
This diffusion is worldwide. And this is one, remember I said the file, the red file, some of the stuff that is on the top of the list of what the human race should never, ever find out about?
Indeed,
this diffusionism is one of those things. That's why they will rather pay PhDs and give them their budgets to run around and not answer questions. And even if they then have to answer a question, they'll do so in a way that creates 100 other questions. This is what they'll do. Because the last thing you can find out about is the reason why there's cocaine in the tombs of Egyptian pharaohs is because there was a connection between South America and Egypt.
That's right. Absolutely right.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow, what a thunder, you know, thunder has struck, lightning has flashed, we can't accept it, it's too immense. Listen, of course then they're going to think people like myself are crazy when we talk about Atlantis and Lemuria. I mean, look at the world we're living in, Henrik.
Yeah.
Look how primitive people are in their mind.